Well, it was nice to hear Andrew using his superintendent's privilege. In 1990, he came as a young stripling to me to be trained in the ways of the Methodist ministry. And I think I must have urged him then never to be afraid of exercising his superintendent's privilege. Anyway, it's very nice to be here and to have had all the warm welcomes and to have seen some of you from time to time in London at Wesley's Chapel and to see you again here in your natural habitat. I'd never been to Rosyth before, but as I read about it, I felt strangely at home. The little village, well, 6,000 or 7,000 people that I grew up in South Wales, bears many resemblances. We had not a naval dockyard built at the beginning of the 19th century, but a Royal Ordnance factory. We had prefab houses, just as you did, where two of my Sunday school teachers lived. It was that late on before they got rid of them. And also we had a garden suburb. We were already a town. You were created out of nothing, out of the dust of the earth, it seems to me. So you were a garden city. But we were already a town, and therefore our garden community was called a garden suburb. We had docks. I lived not 2 minutes' walk away from them, not a naval dockyard. But my brother and I used to dive off the gantry cranes that used to take the trucks full of anthracite coal and load them into the little coastal shipping vessels that took them around Britain. So, yes, I feel quite close to it all, really. The garden city, 100 years old, just as this church, this Methodist fellowship, is 100 years old. And I'm very glad, therefore, to come as a kindred spirit from another devolved part of the United Kingdom. But it's also interesting to me that the first person who welcomed people into his or to their home, that they are the beginning of Methodism in this place. That's often the story of Methodism. It was someone in their home, or a soldier on duty, or a ship's captain, or a tradesman, or, you know, that sort of person going about their ordinary everyday business, who just got a few people together, and that was the seed for all that happened afterwards. I hope all of you have seen the wonderful irony of the fact that that first hospitality was offered by a Mr. Gardener from the Garden City. That's not bad, is it? It could have been Mr. Spicemonger or Mr., I don't know, Collywaddles or anything, really. But it was Mr. Gardener and Mrs. Gardener. And if you wonder about why I've chosen this verse from the Epistle to the Hebrews as a kind of text for my sermon, there it is. And having been made perfect, he became unto all them that obey him the author of eternal salvation. You only have to think that that was the very verse that was written on the first class ticket that Mr. Gardener had. So from the very outset, this has been the verse under which the evolving fellowship here in Rosyth has developed. Now, I could, of course, at this point, just emphasize the fact that whatever we think we're doing today, we are actually wanting to do homage to Christ. For without him, there is no dispensation for us to enjoy fellowship at all. It is his name, his example, his teaching, his suffering, his death, his resurrection and ascension that are the core of everything that we stand for. And it says here, having been made perfect, he, for all who obey him, is the author of eternal salvation. If we want to know what wholeness, what the truly, deeply meaningful life is all about, it is through obeying him that we will not only find it, but be given it. Well, that's what I could have done, but I didn't in the end decide to do that. It's interesting that having been made perfect is how that verse starts. In the most recent issue of Contact, under the editorship now of Professor Kirby, just let's remember that, there is a photocopy of that first class ticket with this text printed on it. And on the opposite page, when you open the magazine, there is a sermon about perfection by Professor Sawkins. And I read it with great interest, and a pretty good fist he makes of it too. But it's about how we can be, or are called to be, perfect. And I have to say that if ever there was a confusing piece of theology done by John Wesley, it was on the doctrine of Christian perfection. He changed his position more often than our leading politicians who want us to get in or out of Europe at the moment have changed theirs. But its basic understanding is that we are not to be static in our faith, but that we are to go on working at the things of faith in the hope that we will grow in love, perhaps towards a perfection that we couldn't possibly achieve in our own right. Well, I'd like to think that that's what it is, but in the verse from Hebrews, it's not we who are being made perfect at all. It's Christ who has been made perfect, and in his perfection lies the secret of us having anything to grow towards at all. So we give proper honor to Christ. And no anniversary, even a centenary anniversary in Rosyth, can neglect to focus its attention on that fact. Talking about perfection, a friend of mine once dared to ask his congregation if anybody in front of him could say that he was perfect. And, well, of course, he expected the answer no, but a man at the back put his hand up. What, said the preacher? I mean, it is dangerous to ask a congregation questions, by the way. And any budding preacher here should be warned never to do it, because you'll get answers. But you say you're perfect? He said, well, not exactly, he said. I'm speaking proxy for my wife's first husband. Now, another reason for being drawn to this verse from Hebrews and this passage from Hebrews was rather special. But once again, the superintendent has used his privilege in bringing this great big historical artifact along that reminds us of the relationship between those who met in fellowship and the dockyard and the very early nature of the cementing. Of course, Richard Charlesworth was himself a chaplain to the dockyard and so did most of his work on the ships anyway. So this is a terrific piece of proof of how closely embedded in the psyche of this community the Methodist Fellowship here is. But I was interested because I also have a special Bible, but you can see how puny mine is compared to the one the superintendent, using his privilege, brought along. But mine is special too. This is the Bible that was given to Michael Ramsay, the 100th Archbishop of Canterbury, when he was consecrated as Bishop of Durham in 1952. When Michael Ramsay was near to death, he gave this to a priest who was chaplain to him through his last time on this earth. And that priest himself came to the end of his life. And he wanted to give it to somebody, and so he chose us at Wesley's Chapel. Me, I have to say, although it'll end up at Wesley's Chapel. Because, he said, Michael Ramsay had wanted with all his heart the unity of Anglicans and Methodists that was put forward in 1969, and whereas Methodists accepted it by the necessary majority and effectively voted themselves out of existence, the Anglicans weren't so brave. And although they voted in favor in all three houses of the convocation, they didn't arrive at the necessary percentage. to effect the transition. It broke Michael Ramsay's heart. He really wanted to resign from being Archbishop of Canterbury. Just read his biography, you'll see all about it. And so when this old priest came towards his death, he wanted to hand this on to a Methodist to be used on ecumenical occasions just as a living memory of the commitment of Michael Ramsay and of so many others in the Church of England and I'm sure of the Episcopal Church of Scotland to the cause of unity. I think they'd have got great pleasure from the way things have happened here with two congregations meeting in this place. But when I showed this Bible to the Bishop of London, he took it from me in a cavalier sort of way. He's a princely bishop, is the Bishop of London. And he took it and he said, ha-ha, he said, I thought that. He said, he just thumbed through it. Just what I thought, the old boy never read it. It's pristine, pristine, look at it, look at it. Never been opened. Well, that isn't quite true. Much of it might not have been opened, but the Epistle to the Hebrews has been opened, read, and reread, and underlined. And all the passages that have been underlined in the Epistle to the Hebrews relate to priesthood. Priesthood. Is priesthood all about being bigger and better than people who aren't priests, having authority over them, a bigger voice than theirs, a better place in the scheme of things, nice processions and wonderful garb? Is that what being a priest is all about? The apostolic succession, coming down one after another, unbroken since the time? Is that what it's all about? Is it doctrinal? Is it liturgical? Is it aesthetic? Is it historic? What is it, this priesthood that we seek to belong to? Well, in Jesus' case, he cared for none of that. The order of Melchizedek, the order of that had no lineage or background or justification. In the school of suffering and service, Jesus did his work and offered whatever it was that his priesthood was all about. I just love this aspect of Michael Ramsay's life. And it obliges me to look at your realities here. Yes, he would love the fact that you have a covenanted relationship, that you are committed formally to enjoying fellowship and developing it between you, the Episcopal Church of Scotland and the Methodist Church here in Rosyth. He'd love that. Indeed, he'd love it down at Wesley's Chapel too, because we have a covenanted relationship with St. Giles Cripplegate, our parish church. And we stand at each other's altar, and we share each other's patronal festivals, and we have study days and pilgrimages and all kinds of things. It's a brilliant relationship, wonderful. Now, Michael Ramsay would love all of that. It still grieves me that the Methodist Church and the Anglican Church have not found an even stronger unity with an interchangeability of ministers, with a more functional approach to their joint activities, saving an awful lot of bureaucracy and doublethink and so on. Grieves me, but I have gone almost beyond that. On Wednesday of last week, my Korean colleague at Wesley's Chapel gave a talk about the origins of Christianity in his country. It's only 100 years old, about the same age as this church. Christianity in Korea, from 0%, it's got up to 31% or 2%. But when the earliest missionaries came to South Korea, or to Korea because it wasn't divided then, they were not wanted at all in that land. They were rejected. They were thrown out. And the one who was particularly, he was killed, but he had time to throw his Bible back onto Korean soil. And one of the devotees of Christianity, not allowed to practice it, took the pages of that Bible and wallpapered his house with it. He wasn't allowed to have a Bible, but he was allowed to have wallpaper. And the first fellowship came along with people going into his house to read the Bible on his walls. That's pretty cool, isn't it, really, when you think about it? But he was saying, was Awakido, when he talked to us last Wednesday, he was saying that in order to have a hearing on the streets of the cities of Korea, they had to adopt a kind of loud presence to draw attention to themselves, because Confucianism, Buddhism, Shintoism, and Shamanism were the prevailing cultural as well as religious forces. And so a very Pentecostal, very loud, very ebullient sort of style of worship evolved. They're only just beginning to modify it now. But that's how Christians defined themselves against the other religions that they met. I lived in Haiti for many years. There, we Protestants had to define ourselves against the prevailing Catholic hierarchy and social dominance. Down in London, why, we nonconformists have to define ourselves against the Church of England, the prevailing, almighty, established church. In Scotland, I guess, the prevailing cultural forces are Presbyterianism and Catholicism, and for Methodists as a minority cause, and indeed Anglicans as a minority cause, you have to hold hands together and define yourselves against the prevailing cultures. Now, I think that we've reached a point where those kinds of equations no longer matter. The real cultural force against which people of faith now have to define themselves are secular and not religious. It is now the time, well, if we don't do it now, we'll never do it. If we don't join forces to present a united front to a world that is increasingly secularized, godless, amoral, if we don't join forces to fight that battle, then we deserve to die each in our little corner, unloved and unwanted. Do you remember the Sunday school hymn about you in your small corner and I in mine? Jesus bids us shine with a pure, clear light. And shine is what we have to do. It's not enough for Anglicans and Methodists to join in a kind of way. They must all enlist in the army that fights against godlessness, amorality, selfishness, postmodernity, and all the forces that assail us in this age. Thinking of how bewildering a time it is to be alive? Well, we can do something about it together. Can't do much apart. Yes, that's a big vision, but then you didn't ask this fancy fella from London to come on up and just tell you nice trite little things about Rosyth and how lovely it is to meet some beautiful Scottish people and how I'll be praying for them when they play their rugby match this afternoon. You didn't want me to do all of that. You live on a bigger map, my friends, a bigger map, and Christ didn't die to save the people of Rosyth alone. He died to save the whole world. You know, we have this great moment at Wesley's Chapel. It's one of the unforgettable moments. We have 55 different nationalities represented in our congregation. We have over 20 mother tongues spoken by our people. And I did make the mistake of asking people what their favorite Bible text was. I had a sermon I'd labored long and hard on. It was beautiful. It was crafted. It was stylistic. It had all the qualities of genius, to be quite honest. But I made the mistake of asking people what their favorite verse was. And I got all kinds of answers. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. So many. Until somebody said, John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And once that was out of the bag, that became the favorite of the day. So then I said, who can say it in a language other than English? And the hands went up. And we heard those wonderful words spoken in Japanese and Tagalog from the Philippines and Korean and Chinese. We heard it, at that time there was a civil war going on in Sri Lanka, but we heard it in the Tamil and the Sinhalese languages of that island. So that although people were killing each other in a civil war, the truth was that God did not send his only son so that Tamils who believed in him should not perish but have everlasting life, or Sinhalese, but that the whole world should be saved. The author of eternal salvation. And then we came into, we had Greek and we had Arabic, down into Africa with Swahili and Sitswana, and we had Fanti and Ga, and we had Yoruba. And then right down into the tip of Africa, we had Hausa, the language of the oppressed during the apartheid years, and Afrikaans, the language of the oppressor. And once again, neither side of that dispute could claim that what God had done in Christ was for them. God so loved the world, not the Afrikaners, the world, not the African tribal constituent parts of the South African rainbow people. And so it went on. We had it in French, but not from France, but from Haiti. In Spanish, but not from Spain, but from Argentina. It was wonderful. Dieu a tant aimé le monde qu'il a donné son fils unique afin que quiconque croit en lui ne périsse point, mais qu'il ait la vie éternelle. Because wherever you are, and whoever you are, even if you come from Rosyth, you are covered by the net that's thrown out to catch you. You are reached by the love that gets into your hearts. You are claimed by the God who made you for a purpose. So I just feel that we people of faith have got to find better ways of presenting our faith to the world. Not contenting ourselves in days of decline with turning inwards upon ourselves, just to keep our spirits up, just to create a chummy, clubby kind of feeling. We are here to serve. And it's when we obey him that we'll know that he is the author of eternal salvation. Now, when I was at our parish church, where we have a covenanted relationship, the Church of St. Giles at Cripplegate is our parish church. The first time I preached there, I remember just standing in front of the congregation, about 20 or 30, like this, ready to preach. I just looked down just to remind myself of what I wanted to say. And I saw that the stone in front of me in the floor carried the words, "Here lie the last mortal remains of John Milton." Gosh, a student of English literature is what I am. And I just couldn't remember what I wanted to preach about any longer. So I gave them the first dozen or so lines of Paradise Lost. And they were totally bewildered. As I expect you to be now, because you're going to have them too. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world. And all our woes and loss of Eden, sing, heavenly muse. Thou from the first wast present, and dove-like sat'st brooding o'er the vast abyss and mad'st it pregnant. What in me is low, raise, what dark, illumine, that to the height of this great argument I may assert the ways of eternal providence and justify the ways of God to man. It's a great, great calling that is ours. We trivialize it at our peril. We turn it into potted meat suppers at our peril. It's a great task. It's to rescue the world from its stupidity. Well, all of that arising from the verse that was on the fellowship card and the verse that I found underlined in Michael Ramsey's Bible. Obeying Christ is what we're called to do. Becoming Christ-like so that we can recognize Him. Not 100 years, not the finest people, but Him as the person who inspires us, who guides our history, who takes us forward into the future. We'll thank Him for all that is past and trust Him for all that's to come. So I can only wish you well as you start your second 100 years. And no doubt in 100 years' time, there'll be another superintendent who will claim the privilege of presenting a big book like this and trumping the visiting preacher's ace. But let me just end in a different way. I'm a member of the House of Lords. My wife thinks that it's gone to my head a bit, and she thinks that I even dream of greater things than that, because she's heard me, I think it must be because I talk in the night or something, but she's heard me dream a dream where I'm standing on a rickety platform at the side of a deep river where ships are being built. I thought this was apposite for here, even if they're not being built anymore. So here am I, on this rickety platform with this great vessel in front of me called HMS, Rosyth Methodism, and Rosyth Church of Scotland Anglicans. Here am I with this great vessel. And I have in my hand an enormous bottle of Methodist de-alcoholized champagne, which is the only kind worth wasting. And I throw it across the bows of HMS Christianity Rosyth. And I watch the vessel slip backwards into a future it can't yet see as it takes to the waters of its second century of existence. And all I can do is, as I ask God to bless this vessel, is to ask Him also to bless all those who sail in her. May God bless you richly and make you the force that transforms society, which I'm certain is His will for all of us. Amen.